Dogma Politica for our fall screening series. Monday, November 21st, Primera, a film on the Chilean uprising. Monday, November 28th, The Clabona Keepers, looking at indigenous land and water defenders on the west coast of Turtle Island. Monday, December 5th, Into the Weeds, a celebrated documentary that looks at the struggle against multinational pesticide company Monsanto. These films show on Mondays at 7 p.m. in room H110 at Concordia University, 1455 de Maisonneuve West, Metro Guy Concordia. Info, cinemapolitica.org. These screenings are a CKUT Radio co-presentation.
Je sais que je suis un bon père de famille. Je sais que je suis un collègue apprécié au bureau. Je sais que je suis un pas pire joueur de hockey. Je sais que je prends bien soin de ma fille qui vit avec des handicaps, même si c'est pas toujours facile. Mais je ne sais pas que je suis une personne proche aidante.
Ce n'est pas toujours évident de le savoir. Si vous soutenez une personne une fois par mois, une fois par semaine ou chaque jour, vous êtes une personne proche aidante. Les personnes proches aidantes, elles sont plus qu'on pense. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
To the CJPME Debrief Podcast, a project of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East and a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. Together, we discuss developments and issues in Canada's relationship with Palestine and the broader Middle East. Through our conversations, we make sense of events in the region and how people in Canada can respond. Today, we hear from CJPME's Michael Buchert, who recently returned from a two-week trip to Palestine, Israel. During his time there, Buchert met with dozens of Palestinian community leaders and organizations, politicians, youth activists, business leaders, and academics. He also visited current hotspots, including Sheikh Jarrah, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and Jenin, as well as unrecognized Bedouin villages in the Naqab. He was also there during Israeli elections, where the people of Israel elected probably their most right-wing government ever, and had the opportunity to ask Palestinians what they thought about the elections. My name is Tom Woodley. I'm the president of CJPME and the podcast host for today. Joining me, of course, is Michael Buchert, the regular co-host of CJPME Debrief. And, of course, Michael's recent trip to Palestine, Israel is the focus of our chat today. So welcome back to Canada, Michael.
Thanks, Tom. It's really good to be back. Yeah, well, we missed you. You left a lot of work with us here back in the office, but we're certainly glad that you had the chance to connect and meet and with people in Palestine and see visit and have a personal experience in a number of different important sites there. Was this your first trip to Palestine, Michael?
No, I had been there once before in 2016 in November as well. I went on a 2-week delegation with the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, the organization founded by Jeff Halper, a Jewish Israeli activist. And the organization rebuilt homes that have been demolished by the Israeli government in the occupied territories, and got to see quite a few different sites, a lot of different cities, spend a lot of time in the occupied West Bank. But this trip was a little bit different, got to see some new places I hadn't been before, and got to see sort of how things have progressed or hadn't progressed in the last 6 years.
Okay. And of course, you did not go entirely alone. You were with two other people. Do you want to talk a little bit about the delegation, the context, how you ended up going, and sort of who you were with as you were touring around and meeting people?
Yeah, this really was the initiative of Peter Larson, who is the chair of the Ottawa Forum on Israel and Palestine, someone we both know really well in Ottawa. And we are also joined by Philip Sherwood, who's a member of the national coordinating team of UNJPI, or the United Network for Justice and Peace in Palestine and Israel, which is a group that does a lot of organizing work within the United Church among church members. And so it was really just the three of us for most of this trip. And Peter helped to, he's made many contacts over the years and has helped to set up a whole bunch of very fascinating meetings with people across the region, and really, really appreciative for inviting me along on this trip. But yeah, it was a bit of a whirlwind. We saw so much, it's even hard to know, where to start.
Yeah, absolutely. Likewise, I extend my thanks and appreciation of Peter. Peter, as you say, have been doing these trips for years. It's taken a lot of people to Israel-Palestine, and it's great. And of course, with the relationships that he has built up over the years, he's really an asset to the broader Palestine solidarity movement in Canada. So hats off and thanks to him, of course. So in general, of course, but you were sort of there wearing the hat of CJPME and sort of representing CJPME and making connections to CJPME. What was the purpose? How would you describe the purpose of your trip overall? What did you hope to achieve through this trip?
Well, there were a few different purposes, I think. I mean, one was just to see it again, to witness firsthand some of, the realities of apartheid that we hear so much about, and to get a feel for, how things are on the ground and what people are saying, get a deeper understanding. But also it was really to connect with individuals and organizations who are doing really important work and are on the forefront of advocating for justice, and so making contact so that we can learn to collaborate better. We can support people on the ground, but also so that we can work together in the future. So I think those are some of the main objectives of this. And as well, I think it was really important. Some of the organizations that we met with are really facing significant attacks from the Israeli government. And it was really important to me to show support from CJPME and to try to build those relationships and see how we can provide further support to them.
Right. Absolutely. And for our listeners, I think you can look forward to in the coming months through these connections that Michael has established. You can look forward to having potentially guests from some of these organizations, some of the people that he met in Palestine who can talk firsthand about what they're facing. So bring that message directly to Canada through this podcast, through other mechanisms. Of course, Michael is already, well, CJPME generally and Michael especially are already in touch with people there. So this will just broaden that network and broaden that that ability to communicate and collaborate. And the other thing often that I find too, Michael, is that, you know, you and I have both experienced situations where we'll be meeting with a politician and they'll say, well, have you been there? And it's very helpful to be able to say, yes, I was there. I was at the demonstration at Sheikh Jarrah, or I met the members of Adamir. You know, so you have that firsthand experience that you've talked to the people, you've seen the site, you've seen what Palestinians are facing. So I think this will have really enduring value for CJPME and its work. And of course, I think for the broader Palestine Solidarity Movement. So why don't you tell us, get into a little bit sort of where exactly sort of you went over the course of your 2 weeks. I guess you arrived on a Wednesday and you left 2 weeks later on a Friday. So you were there sort of, I guess, 2 weeks and sort of 2 days counting travel. Is that right?
Yeah, more or less. That was about it. And it gave us a lot of time to see a lot of things. We traveled quite a bit all over the region, in the occupied Palestinian territories. For example, we went to East Jerusalem, including Sheikh Jarrah and the Old City and Al-Aqsa. We also went up to Ramallah and to Jenin as well, to Bethlehem, some of those key cities. But also we spent quite a bit of time in Israel itself, or what we sometimes call 48 Palestine. Palestinian communities within the state of Israel, communities where the people have citizenship but continue to live as second-class citizens. So, for example, we went to, so-called mixed cities like Jaffa and Haifa, but we also went to areas that are predominantly or exclusively Palestinian cities like Nazareth, to places in the triangle like Umm al-Fahm, which is near the barrier, I guess, near the wall. On the other side of the wall is the West Bank and Jenin, but right up against that, in this area called the Triangle, where there are quite a few Palestinian cities. I guess that land was annexed in 1948 when Israel took control of this area because it thought it was very strategic for them militarily, which is why there are all these Palestinian cities there. So it was really interesting to get a better sense of what life is like for Palestinians who are citizens of Israel. I think this is, we don't talk about them as much maybe as we talk about Palestinians who live under military occupation. But there are significant, I guess you could say, similarities or continuities in the experience of Palestinians who live on both sides of the Green Line. And so getting a really deeper understanding of that was significant. But also I should say, we also went to the Nakab, or the Negev Desert near Beersheba, where there are many unrecognized Bedouin communities that are facing severe pressure. The government is trying to force them out of those communities and into these other towns to clear the room for Jewish development. So overall, quite a few different things we saw. Ask me further questions.
Yeah. Well, it was, I think you used the word whirlwind tour, or is it, that was sometimes used to describe it. I mean, you guys saw an awful lot in just the 2 weeks that you were there. So you covered a lot of ground and as you said, both sides of the Green Line. And I agree with you quite often, the focus in terms of news coverage of Palestine, Israel is on sort of what's happening in the West Bank and Gaza. But the Palestinians who live in Israel are an important part of the global Palestinian diaspora, the global mm-hmm. Palestinian community. And I guess we might come up later in our talk here, but of course they often feel left out of the discussion about Palestinians and are somewhat resentful and want to, and I think CJPME and others have tried to, make sure that they're not forgotten, that they are part of the broader discussion of what Palestinians need to have true justice on both sides of the Green Line. I've had the benefit of having actually read through your report. Hopefully some of the people on this listening to this podcast will take the time to actually read the report. We've published the report on our website, and we've put a link to the report in the show notes. You start off your report by making a number of high-level observations, and I thought it'd be useful just to touch on some of those, because they do sort of give an overall theme to some of the things, or an overall theme to your experience, your observations. So one of the things that you pointed out was how the trip was a confirmation to you of what you'd read about in these many human rights reports from, say, Amnesty International, how Israel has sought to fragment the Palestinians one from another. What was your perception of that? How did you see that? And how does that impact unity among Palestinians?
Yeah, well, it was so interesting to spend time again with Palestinian citizens of Israel, because it really highlighted this reality of fragmentation for me and what it looks like. 20% of the population of citizens of Israel are Palestinian. Israel has for many decades tried to depoliticize their identity and to refer to them not as Palestinians, but as Arabs, as Israeli Arabs. Mm-hmm. and try to cut them off from the rest of the Palestinian people, and as a way of sort of classic divide and control. This has really shown to me, what it looks like on the ground in terms of Palestinians who in many ways face the same experiences and same challenges. I mean, so we were spending time in Umm al-Fahm, which is this city in Israel that looks like it could be in the West Bank. In fact, it even looks almost like a refugee camp in how it's so densely populated. It's on a hill. It's these buildings are basically on top of one another, very crowded, very, little lack of services. And there's a reason for this. It's discriminatory practices. It's, decades of Israeli policies of expropriating Palestinian property, fencing them into tiny areas, not allowing them to expand, discriminatory dispersal of various services. So you see that, this city really looks like the cities that are on the other side of the wall, just kilometers away in the West Bank, where, unlike in Israel, people don't have the right to vote for the Israeli government. They don't have citizenship. They in many ways face much worse conditions, but there's still, there are these continuities between their experiences. And just having these towns that are side by side, virtually both the same people, but on one side of the wall, they have all these rights that are not afforded to people on the other side, is really, it emphasizes just how absurd the situation is and how cruel this is. That, yeah. For example, we traveled from Umm al-Fahm to the other side to Jenin, a Palestinian city in the West Bank. And accompanying us was this young woman who is from Umm al-Fahm, who, she's allowed to travel across the checkpoints into the West Bank with her Israeli ID. And we met with people there in Jenin, people of her age, who aren't allowed to go the other direction, who may never be allowed in their life, may never be given a permit that would allow them to go just, 20 kilometers away to the other side, to Umm al-Fahm, let alone see the ocean, the Mediterranean Sea. The way that these apartheid policies really cut people up and give them different rights, but they're all part of the same people. It's just really eye-opening. That's one of the aspects of what we observed. But the counterpoint to that is that we talked to so many people within Israel who are trying to, fight back against those efforts to divide them, and lots of activist groups, community groups, youth organizations that are trying to build Palestinian identity among those in Israel to build a sense of shared feeling and solidarity with their counterparts in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, and to challenge that depoliticization and that dehumanization that tries to pit them apart.
Yeah. So there's a certain, I guess, as I read your report and listening to you here now, there's a certain awareness that among Palestinians that this is what Israel is trying to do, and a certain very intentional sort of say, no, we're not going to let them do this. We're going to stand with one another. We're, you know, when people in Gaza are under duress, we're going to get out in the streets and show that we stand with the people of Gaza and that sort of thing. So there's a sort of resistance to that fragmentation and adherence to a certain unity. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, and I wouldn't say that. I think that identity in Israel is really complicated, and there are lots of sort of pressures to see themselves as Israeli Arabs, or for whatever reason to get them to sort of shed any sympathy with Palestinians. So it's being contested, and there are many, many people who are really trying to work against those pressures to make sure that they aren't cut off from the rest of the Palestinian people, and to assert that they are one people. But I think one sort of sign of that was really significant that everyone continues to talk about was in May 2021,
right?
When we were all watching as people in Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah were being threatened with being evicted from their homes, and there were these raids on Al-Aqsa, and then airstrikes on Gaza. You actually had a situation where Palestinians across Israel, citizens of Israel, sort of in unprecedented numbers were on the streets demonstrating in solidarity with Palestinians on the other side of the Green Line, in many cases actually getting into street confrontations with Israeli police, were being hit by the same sorts of like rubber bullets and other tactics that Palestinians in the West Bank are faced with, and were in many cases facing violence, street violence from Israelis, Jewish Israelis who went out and attacked Palestinian citizens of Israel during this time as well.
Yeah.
This time is often referred to as the May 2021 uprising or the Unity Intifada, but really a high point in sort of a shared sense of unity of the Palestinian people, and something that has left people feeling a lot more emboldened and a lot more optimistic about the future in some ways. So really interesting to talk to people everywhere about these things.
That's cool. And I guess one other thing that I noticed that I'll highlight from your report is that you sort of talked about how there's a certain shifting which is taking place among the human rights community within Palestine, that shifting, you know, now that all the major human rights organizations internationally have sort of assert now that Israel has imposed the legal definition of apartheid on Palestinians, that Palestinians in Palestine are realize they have to start using the vocabulary of apartheid. I mean, how did that sort of come out, or what did you hear from Palestinians as in that community? Like, how do they revamp the framing to sort of leverage this realization of by the human rights community?
Yeah, this was something that I heard quite a bit, because obviously in Canada, the use of the term apartheid is still controversial. The Canadian government rejects it. There's all this sort of it's so hard to get politicians to accept the findings of human rights groups that what Israel is doing is practicing apartheid. It's really an uphill battle. So we asked people who we spoke to on the ground, and it is non-controversial, obviously, among Palestinians. Everyone agrees. Everyone's been saying for years that it's apartheid. Something that's significant about the Amnesty report, as well as the B'Tselem report, is that they focus not only on what's happening in the occupied Palestinian territories, but say that that apartheid is apartheid everywhere under Israeli control. And for Palestinians who are citizens of Israel, they agree. They say it's apartheid. It's not controversial. They also talk about settler colonialism. And, you know, it's not just that there's a purpose behind apartheid. It's not unequal rights just for the sake of it, but for the purpose of expanding territorial control for one group at the expense of another in mm-hmm. a colonial situation.
Yeah.
So there's lots of conversations about that. And yeah, there's a lot of people who are saying, well, now that, you know, the internationally, they're starting to reflect the same kind of conversations we're having here. We really need to make sure to leverage this and to capitalize on this to, you know, now that people are starting to talk about apartheid, we need to, you know, I don't know what the word, escalate our efforts to make sure that people hear this and they understand this. But I think one thing that's significant about this is that this, often the people who say there's no apartheid in Israel will point to the fact that you have Palestinians in Israel can vote for the Israeli Knesset, and there are political parties. They can be elected to the Knesset. But I spoke to three people who had been elected as Palestinians to the Israeli Knesset in these parties that people refer to them as Arab Israeli parties usually, and they all say yes, it's apartheid. Of course it is. It's worse than apartheid. It's apartheid and occupation. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these are people who have been, again, elected to the Knesset. They are exercising political rights that don't exist for people in East Jerusalem or in the West Bank. And yet they recognize that these are very partial rights and that having this specific form of political power is not enough, and that they can hold this and still be second-class citizens, that they can live in an apartheid reality. And so I think more people should know Israel might point to Palestinians and the Knesset as evidence that there's no apartheid, but if you actually talk to them, they'll tell you it's absolutely apartheid.
Yeah, it's fascinating, and it's that's one of the great things about going there, is that you can actually talk directly to these people and hear directly from them and you know, pose your follow-up questions and really understand very deeply how they feel and how they perceive things. One of the key issues that CJP Me has been following over the past year and a half was Israel's more or less attacks on Palestinian civil society, most notably symbolically through the criminalization of six leading Palestinian civil society organizations. I know that one of your priorities for the trip was to meet with some of these organizations and consult with them. And I know you did that. You met with two of them, I guess, Defense of the Child International Palestine and Adamir Prisoner Support Rights Association, I think is their name, something like that. Why don't you tell us about your meetings with DCIP and Adamir?
Yeah, this was really important because this is an issue that we've been following very closely. And I assume most listeners are familiar, but just over a year ago, Israel basically designated these six leading organizations, which are really the leading Palestinian NGOs in the sector, as terrorist organizations, and really putting them at risk of all sorts of things, really trying to shut them down completely. Mm-hmm. And just a few months ago in August, there were actually raids on these organizations, on their offices in Ramallah, where Israeli soldiers came in, confiscated files, damaged property, and sealed the doors shut to try to prevent people from getting back in, and then leaving these orders saying, you know, this is a banned organization. If you continue working here, you will be, you could be prosecuted. So very significant attack on the sector. And, you know, Canada had basically been totally silent on this. And we can talk more about that later. But there are, I was able to speak to two of these groups to visit their offices in Ramallah, Defense for Children International Palestine and Adamir Prisoner Support and Human Rights Association. We got to go to their offices, which DCIP is right above their old office, where you can see their door, which is still significantly damaged from the Israeli raids. And Adamir, they're across the hall from their old office, which is severely damaged. And we got to speak to the heads of these groups about the work that they do. DCAP, you know, and monitors the rights of children under occupation, reports on children who have been killed, or, you know, defends children who are in the military court system. And Adamir deals with legal rights of detainees, of political prisoners in Israeli prisons, and especially in the military court system. And both of them talked about how these terrorism designations have really affected their work in many ways. You know, they continue to operate. They're still doing, you know, they're still trying to do their best to defend human rights and through this critical work. But they talk about this sort of this climate of fear and uncertainty where, you know, as a result of these designations, they could be they could be arrested at any time. They could be prosecuted. You know, their offices, their stuff could be confiscated for good. Actually, in this case, because they're now terrorist organizations under Israeli law, they have lost legal rights, for example, to reclaim property that had been confiscated previously. And we heard from Adamir that their lawyers they have to act privately. They can't say that they're affiliated with Adamir when they're defending clients because they don't know what will happen. And so they continue to operate. But, you know, if they go to East Jerusalem, if they go through the checkpoint, at any time they could be arrested or worse. You know, there's no legal rights really for people who are designated terrorists in Israel. So it's a really, really serious situation for them.
Yeah, yeah. Now, related to this, as you were, you know, at the end of your trip, as you were leaving through the Tel Aviv airport, there was some awkward questioning of you. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so because of my meetings with these organizations, when I was leaving passport control, my passport was flagged automatically. And I had to wait for a while they took my passport to behind this booth. And after quite some time, the security agent came to speak to me and asked me all these questions about who I had met with and all of this, and he accused me of having met with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which Israel declares a terrorist organization. And it's this, so the whole... these fraudulent claims against the six NGOs is really based on this claim that that they're actually operating as fronts of the PFLP, and that therefore that's how Israel determines them to be terrorist groups. And of course, no one in the world, no country in the world has found those claims credible, but that's the argument. So him grilling me, accusing me of meeting with the PFLP and warning me, giving me a warning that this could affect my entry to Israel if I meet with them. I interpret it as a clear threat against myself or anyone who is attempting to go to Palestine to meet with the most prominent human rights groups that are operating there. So it was really, you know, I got away without being sort of immediately deported, which is good. But I think it's a warning that people are not welcome to meet with human rights groups in the region. And it's quite significant of a threat.
Yeah. Yeah. Just mind blowing. It's just, you know, that anyway, there's so much you could say on that, but we'll move on. Now, the Canadian government has been silent, largely silent and certainly uncritical of Israel's criminalizing of these six groups. Did the people at Adamir or DCIP, did they say anything about the Canadian government's response? Are they disappointed? How do they feel? What would they have wanted from Canada? What was their expectation, ideally?
Yeah, like you said, our impression here was that Canada was sort of uniquely silent on this. We've seen a lot of other governments, European governments in particular, express skepticism about Israel's designation against these groups, and have sort of pledged to continue working with the NGOs. Even, you know, the US and the CIA have said that they don't find Israel's evidence against the groups to be credible. Canada hasn't expressed an opinion either about the labeling of the groups as terrorists or in support of the groups themselves. Is put out a couple of statements that are very vague about civil society, but nothing that comes anywhere close to actual criticism, which is really shameful. Anyway, that's been our impression from the outside, and they did confirm that they've been having meetings, briefings, all sorts of things, and Canada has been completely missing from all of that. Adamir said that following the designation of them as terrorists, that you had tons of diplomats from other countries come to show support, but the U.S. and Canada were not among them. There is definitely a sense that Canada is sort of following with whatever the U.S. is doing. They definitely don't look highly, think highly of the Canadian government's approach on this. And they said that what needs to happen, what governments like Canada need to do, is to publicly demand the withdrawal of these designations. Because, some countries might want to say, well, we don't believe in what Israel is saying, but so we'll just act as if these designations don't exist. But what these organizations are saying, that's not good enough, because that means that the threat is still there, that at any time there's still that threat that they could be arrested, that there could be violence against them. So right. What needs to happen is for those designations to go away. And that's something that we brought. We brought those messages when we went and saw the Canadian officials in Ramallah as well.
Yeah. Well, and it's not just that as you say, the threat is still there for these organizations, but if there's no price to pay for Israel, if there's no pressure on them to remove these designations, if countries like Canada don't take steps to sort of say to Israel, look, you've got to stop doing this. These are human rights organizations. Well, then Israel will continue. They'll continue to crack down. They've already cracked down in certain fashions. And, fortunately, the two organizations that you met have been able to set up shop, next door and continue their operations. But, that could end tomorrow. So yeah, it's very important that Canada get involved as other countries have. So I guess then you went. As I understand, it was the very same day you ended up meeting also with the Canadian rep to the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah. So what was that conversation like, and how did the Canadian rep defend himself or defend Canada's position on this? What did he say?
Yeah, it was. I have mixed feelings on this. I think overall it was useful to have a conversation with Canada's reps. But it was certainly not satisfying. We went to the Canadian mission. We spoke to the new representative, who David Da Silva, who had started in that position probably 2 weeks earlier, so it was very new, and some of the political staff at the office as well. And we talked about a number of issues, but the number one thing was obviously relaying to them what we had heard from these organizations about the lack of Canada's response and the need to be outspoken. And I still didn't get any clarity on where Canada stands. I do think that they want us to have the impression that Canada is, behind the scenes criticizing this, sort of, telling Israel that it doesn't support this, but there's no evidence of this. Even in that meeting, they didn't give an actual opinion on any of this, which was really disappointing. And actually, Da Silva did sort of outline what I guess is Canada's sort of theory of change in this. He says that, well, it's no good for us to be, No, what he said is that it's more effective for Canada, because Canada has such a close relationship with Israel, that it can actually use its close connection to bring up these issues. Well, he didn't say this one specifically, but issues in general, up with Israeli officials behind the scenes, and that they'll listen to Canada. Whereas maybe if Canada was more outspoken, they would have less leverage behind the scenes. They wouldn't have an opportunity to bring these things up. That's Canada's line in terms of how it justifies not speaking up about really anything. Of course, as I told them, this doesn't make any sense, because effectively it means Canada doesn't have a public position. you know, not just on the six organizations, but on all sorts of human rights abuses. It means that certainly, like from the outside, like how are we supposed to evaluate Canada's approach? We have absolutely no evidence. We don't know what their position is, and we don't know what they're saying behind the scenes. It's sort of, we have to sort of trust that they have the right position and that they're bringing that forward, and there's just no reason to do that. So it's just, yeah, really something that needs to be challenged. I think we need to continue pushing for them to actually speak out, because, you know, or demand maybe some concrete evidence of what have you accomplished through this method? Can you give us any examples? Because it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. 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 Very disappointing. And, I mean, one of the things that I say is, you know, it's good that, anyway, maybe I won't go into that, but yeah, their expectation that, well, we just sort of have to trust what they're doing behind the scenes. But, you know, if they are doing something behind the scenes, it has had no impact.
Yeah, exactly. That's so exactly it.
If somehow they had this great relationship with Israel and they're putting tons of pressure on Israel behind the scenes to, you know, stop this criminalization of these human rights groups, well, nothing's happened, so it's not working. But we should move on, I guess. You're also there. Your visit coincided with the Israeli legislative elections, their fifth election in 4 years. I actually was there years and years ago during an Israeli election. It was fascinating for me when I was there, and I'm sure it was fascinating for you. I guess, as most people know, the result of the election was that Israel elected perhaps the most extreme far-right government, or the government is about to be formed. It will probably be the most extreme far right government that they've ever had. What was the perspective of those you met with, I guess, Palestinians and I guess progressive Israelis? What was the perspective of the people that you met, and what's their prognosis following this election?
Yeah, it's interesting because there was quite a bit of discussion in sort of the Israeli media about the election results, which I think the tone is really of you know, significant alarm about what the outcome is, because you have Benjamin Netanyahu come back with the support of this extreme far right party, Religious Zionism, which you know, it's going to be the third biggest party as part of the coalition, and likely these extremists will have minister positions. And so this was something that was talked about quite a bit in the Israeli media, but among Palestinians in Israel and in the occupied Palestinian territories, mostly people you know, it was sort of same old, same old. Like, obviously, there is a concern because some of the people who will be in the next government have said awful things about Palestinians, have called for deporting Palestinian citizens of Israel, have supported Jewish terrorists who have, you know, undertaken attacks against Palestinians. Obviously there's a huge danger in an immediate sense, but it's not seen as any dangerous necessarily compared to the last government, because of course we remember that this outgoing government murdered Shireen Abu Akleh. They shut down human rights groups. They bombed Gaza. They're doing all sorts of things on a daily basis. This is the most violent year in a long time. More than 50 children have been shot to death in the West Bank this year. What difference is it going to make for them? A slight change in the composition of the government. From their perspective, it's actually almost better, because at least now this is a government that will be open about its intentions. This is the real face of Israel, and it will be easier to confront that compared to a government that has the same destructive policies towards Palestinians, but which cloaks it in sort of a veil of sort of liberal values.
Right.
So
right.
That's kind of the perspective that I heard.
Yeah. Well, I guess, and just to clarify, it'll be better because it'll be the clear face. And so it'll be easier for the international community to sort of say, hey, we just don't agree with what you're saying. We don't agree with these outright racist policies. Whereas, as you say, the previous governments might have cloaked it in these little liberal democratic values that the new government that seems to be coming together, might not do that and might just be openly racist, with shamelessly openly racist.
More than it currently is. Yeah,
even more than it currently is. And I guess you met a number of Palestinians who have Israeli citizenship who are allowed to vote in Israeli elections, unlike Palestinians who live in the occupied territories. What was their take on the elections? Did all of them vote? And how did they vote? How did they participate in these elections?
This was definitely something that I heard mixed perspectives on. Quite a few people I spoke to refused to vote, have boycotted elections maybe all their lives because they do not see any benefits of electing Palestinian members to the Knesset. And they see it as sort of giving undue legitimacy to a racist institution, which ultimately is only furthering their oppression. And, you know, it's a very sort of symbolic representation that they are capable of getting. So I heard that quite a bit. But we also heard from people who were supporting different political parties, Hadash, as well as Balad. And we spoke to the leader of Balad, Sami Adushari, and as well as we spoke to Jabrin, Yusuf Jabrin of Hadash, who both of these people had previously served in the Israeli Knesset. And, you know, it's interesting because even for them, politics, sort of this formal politics isn't really that significant. Or I guess like Balad in particular, you know, is a political party that fights for Israel to be a state of all its citizens, rather than to be a state that privileges its Jewish citizens. And is, you know, in that sense is quite radical in challenging some of the fundamental racist structures of the state. And for that reason is often, they try to disqualify it from running in the first place. But I guess from the start, they really saw the, you know, Israeli elections, not really as an end in itself, but as just a way to sort of have a platform to speak about these issues, about equality and about ending discrimination. And it's not really necessarily about winning power in the Knesset, which obviously they can never do. And I spoke to, you know, people who were formerly very, very involved in Balad and were actually positive about the election result, that, you know, Balad didn't even meet the electoral threshold. It got a big momentum, a big boost in votes more than ever before, but it didn't pass the electoral threshold. So there's no members in the Knesset. But they were optimistic because they see the enthusiasm around it. They see the party being sort of energized, and they're not looking for the point of participating in politics isn't about being in the Knesset. It's about using it as a tool for struggling for equality. And so, it was really interesting to talk to people about this. Very, very interesting opinions.
Yeah, fascinating. Seriously. Yeah, really seems interesting. And I guess we get down to our last few questions here. Probably a lot of people are curious what the Palestinians that you spoke to, what do they think about the two-state solution? Is the two-state solution still possible?
Yeah, this is something that we asked people, but obviously we didn't do a poll of people. But, you know, when we are meeting with people, we often would ask them whether they support a two-state solution or what is sort of their ideal political outcome. And almost nobody we spoke to actually said that they support a two-state solution. Most people said that they actually are opposed to a two-state solution because they see it as very unfair to all Palestinians, and they worry about the consequences of Palestinian citizens of Israel again being excluded from that, being a part of separated from others who would be in a Palestinian state. You know, I don't know, there's so much we could say about that. It's really interesting. But the flip side is that many people also really, when you ask them what is their preferred political outcome. They talk about a single democratic state. They talk about Palestinian and Jewish unity within a state. And, you know, you talk to young people and you ask them, you know, given everything you've gone through, can you live with Jewish Israelis in a state? And they say, yes, of course. But it has to be in a situation where we're not second-class citizens. Yeah. You know, they won't accept, the Palestinians in Israel will not accept to continue to accept being second-class citizens. So yeah, definitely that was an overwhelming position among people we spoke to. The only place we really found support for a Tuesday solution was in the Canadian embassy, but it doesn't really exist elsewhere.
Right. So basically no Palestinians, at least that you met, so sort of felt like the two-state solution had any future or was pertinent to them. And as you say, the Canadian government seems totally out of touch with that.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think I guess another thing I'm hearing from you in your final comments there was that that the question of equality, equality of citizens is entirely separate from the question of, you know, what might be some sort of geopolitical framework, that regardless of whatever final geopolitical structure there may be, the equality of citizens is what is most important to Palestinians on the ground.
Yeah, equality is one thing, but I also think that that a lot of people wouldn't be satisfied, for example, with Israel becoming a totally equal state, but there also being a second Palestinian state in which they're cut off from the rest of their community. I don't know if people would be very happy with that, but then I don't know if Israelis would be happy with that either. So I think, you know, we spoke to Jeff Halper and Awad Abdel Fattah, who are co-founders of the campaign for a one democratic state. And it was interesting to talk to them because they are actively trying to build a movement across among Palestinians and Jewish Israelis to really campaign and create a movement around a demand for a one democratic state. But at the moment, there's no authoritative voice that's really pushing this call. And so it's hard to see sort of any movement towards it happening in the near future.
Yeah. And your report, having read your report, and you have some good discussion in there about that, and how, in as much as there is, as you've just said, in as much as there are people that are thinking about this, what will the one state solution, what would a one state solution look like, or a single state? Currently, there's no one on the political scene who is in any position to sort of push for that. Let's just wrap up, I think, with this one final question. You know, at the top of our conversation, we talked about, you know, making connection with Palestinian human rights leaders and groups. Who are some of the people and organizations that you hope to stay in touch with? And how do you hope your new relationships can bolster our common work?
I mean, there's so many people we met with who are really doing fantastic work. A lot of it within Israel that I definitely need to stay connected to them. Sort of at a more immediate level, I want to continue to build these relationships with DCIP and Adamir and the other groups that are targeted, and see how we can try to bring the Canadian government around on showing support for them. I think that's really critical. Mm-hmm. We already rely on their work. Obviously, these are organizations that produce the important on the ground research about what the situation is. But we can do more to be active participants in sharing that information with Canadians. And, but also, I mean, another example of someone who we spoke to, we met with the leaders of the BDS movement and the Palestinian Academic Cultural Boycott Campaign in Ramallah, and talked about the need to continue building connections between the Palestinian boycott movement as it is on the ground, and connecting that to Canadian activists and supporting the work, building that solidarity. I think that's going to be really significant, especially with this new far right government. You know, forms of political, economic pressure are going to be more important than ever. So building those connections is significant. And I think it'll be good to be more connected again to Palestinians in Israel so that, you know, we're more attuned to that specific aspect. We're usually talking about occupied territories, but I need to remind myself of this will help me to remind myself to think beyond that, and to be holistic in sort of how we advocate for a future without apartheid.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Michael, we're so glad that you went, and clearly it was a very fruitful trip. I think both at a personal level for you and also at an organizational level for us in terms of having now connections and linkages that, and hopefully, a more collaborative way of doing work with these organizations that we can bring them as much support and assistance and amplify what they're trying to do here in Canada. So thanks for taking the time to do that. And we're so glad you got in and out without being thrown in jail by the Israelis.
Yeah, I'm glad to.
And as I said, glad to have you back. And if people would like to share their thoughts or experiences with us about Michael's trip, if they have different ideas on what Palestinians are saying, we'd love to hear from folks. But I guess we'll wrap it up there, Michael. Anything more we should say?
No, that's good. Thanks so much for chatting with me about this.
Oh, it's great. Well, we had to do a podcast on this. It's not every day that for someone like CJPME, for an organization like CJPME, to have the luxury of having someone be a delegate to the Palestinians and meet them in this way. So it's fantastic. We would have been remiss in not hosting you here. So if you're a listener today and you've enjoyed our podcast, please subscribe to our channel. We're on all the major audio podcast platforms. Of course, if you can, please leave a positive review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps other people to find our program and also to learn about the issues. This podcast is a project of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East, CJPME, and seeks to advance its mission to empower Canadians of all backgrounds to promote justice, development, and peace in the Middle East. As I mentioned a moment ago, if you have any comments, you can email us at info@cjpme.org. Thanks to all our supporters who helped to make this podcast and all of CJPME's other activities possible. Thanks also to Madeleine Moffat, our podcast engineer and consultant. So that's it for now. We'll look forward to having everyone with us again for our next podcast. Take care. We'll see you soon.
So that's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
the aftermath of her American and European tours, Myriam Gendron is coming home to Montreal with a single show at Cabaret La Tulipe on Thursday, December 8th. Come discover why tasteful musicians like Kurt Weill, Will Oldham, Bill Callahan admire Gendron's songs and stage presence. Myriam will share the evening with the dazzling fingerpicking of the great Glenn Jones. Tickets are on sale online. Don't miss this one. A heavy trip and CKUT co-presentation.
C'était une jeune fille. And you know, baby,
Simon Padad and Seamus, stay locked on to Soca Session on the Seacock 90.3 FM. Hey, where they play brand new soca in Montreal. Simon Padad and Seamus. No, 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 no.
Thank you for calling the Miami Carnival Emergency Hotline. Your call is important to us. To activate the usual, boring Miami Carnival mixes, press 1. To activate Revel Nation's Revel for the Road mix by Dr. Eason and International Steven, press 2. Warning, you have selected 2. If you are currently in the office, in a healthy relationship, or still have no money to pay off your costume, disconnect now. Your behavior ends here.
Revel Nation Carnival.